Hi, glad to be here again. And let me just quickly introduce Jamal. Jamal Rahman, J-A-M-A-L-R-A-H-M-A-N, is a Muslim Sufi interfaith minister. He's originally from Bangladesh. He is co-founder and co-minister at the Interfaith Community Church in Seattle, Washington. He travels a lot. He lectures a lot. He's the author or co-author of a number of books. He is the author of a great book that I can recommend called The Fragrance of Faith, The Enlightened Heart of Islam, and co-author of two other newer books, Out of Darkness into Light, Spiritual Guidance in the Quran with Reflections from Jewish and Christian Sources, and Getting to the Heart of Interfaith, The Eye-Opening, Hope-Filled Friendship of a Pastor, a Rabbi, and a Sheikh. And so let me just end by saying Jamal is part of an amazing little group of three interfaith ministers, Pastor Don McKenzie, a Christian, a Rabbi Ted Falcon, Jew, and Sheikh Jamal Rahman, the three interfaith amigos. You gotta love it. So welcome, Jamal.
I'm delighted to be on the program. Thank you for the invitation.
Good. And I'm just going to begin by asking Jamal quickly to tell us a little bit about some of the work he's doing right now. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about how you and Don and Ted got together as the Interfaith Amigos.
Yes. Well, I should probably start by saying I actually have two ministries. One is with my own spiritual community, and we are housed in a church we own called Interfaith Community Church. In fact, it's the oldest church in Seattle. And we kept the name church for a variety of reasons. And in this place, we foster what we like to say a living, breathing interfaith community, asking ourselves, what does it really mean to be interfaith, even though you're a Muslim or a Jew or a Christian? How does it manifest? That's, I would say, 50% of my work. The other 50%, the one you asked about, Jim, is after 9/11, it just so happened accidentally, Rabbi Ted Falcon, Pastor Don McKenzie, United Church of Christ, and myself, we got together, and that developed into a sort of a continuous, abiding friendship. And we began to meet after the 9/11 program we had regularly, sometimes 3-4 times a week, and we developed a genuine friendship. And from that, we began to do spiritual direction among ourselves, and many, many programs emerged from that, including a radio talk show, a trip to the Middle East, writing a book together. Now we're writing a second book. Then we had, amazingly, just recently, a year ago, rather extensive coverage by New York Times, CBS Evening News, PBS. And suddenly we are still dining out on that, visiting different places and giving talks and really engaging in interfaith programs all over.
I think that's really terrific. And the piece in the New York Times on the three interfaith amigos, I looked it up on Google and you can still find it. It was a beautiful spread and it's well worth Googling, just New York Times interfaith amigos, and you can find it. Let me just say quickly that one of the themes that we keep returning to in the course of this conversation is one that you're familiar with, Jamal, and it is the idea of living in an age of cultural evolution. We've made several references to the book I wrote about that called Thriving in the Cross Current, and my term for the period of intensified, accelerated cultural evolution through which we find ourselves living right now, as you know, Jamal, is sea change. So we have that in the background that we might very well be living in a time of sea change, even though, as we'll talk about later in the call, it doesn't always seem that way. And what would a period of cultural evolution, what would it mean with respect to growing understanding and dialogue and even engagement between various religious communities? So I'm going to put that out there as a question that we want to touch on as often as we can. And I also want to mention, and Barbara, maybe you can help me here, we have some documents that are available on the website, and Barbara can say where those are. One is just a sort of intro to many of the religions of the world in very short form. It's called The Excellences of the World's Religions, and it's inspired by a Swiss theologian named Fritjof Schuon, S-C-H-U-O-N, wrote a book called The Transcendent Unity of Religions, and in that book he said something I've never forgotten, which is that every religion, you'll like this, Jamal, every religion is superior to every other by virtue of something it does best. Something it does best. And we also have a piece that talks about the master stories of each of several religions. What's the great story? What's the great ritual act or ritual celebration? And finally, what's the ethical norm? So you might want to touch on those. And let me just mention that when we talk about Islam, what the document says as the excellence of Islam, see how this strikes you, Jamal, the transformative power of the reconciliation of the personal will to the will of the divine, peaceful surrender to God, and embrace of a detailed vision of God's plan for nearly every dimension of human life, and the sacralization of every moment of that life. Is that a fair statement about the excellence at the heart of Islam?
I would say in theory, absolutely. Maybe I should refer back to my friendship with Ted and Don, the rabbi and the pastor. You know, as I got to know them over the years and became very good friends, I began to realize, I jokingly say, that both Ted and Don, the rabbi and the pastor, are two of the best Muslims I know. because to be a Muslim simply means one who has surrendered one's to God. In other words, has gone beyond the limited private will in ushering into the divine will. And as the Quran says, so one can bring a heart turned in devotion to God. So this is a very key concept in Islam, and it requires a lot of inner work, a lot of the work which we call the most inconvenient work of transforming the ego, opening up the heart, and then really being of authentic service to others. But this is something I'd rather, look to you to do for yourself, but not do it myself. That's the main problem. The other thing I would say, Jim, is that you mentioned about the sea changes. It is very clear that to survive in a multi-religious society, we really have to practice what, if you use a popular idiom, is called practicing the three cups of tea from the famous book of Greg Mortensen, which is, listen, respect, and connect. And really to be able to do this with the other who is different. So if one surrenders one's ego to God, and if one practices the three cups of tea, in theory, one is a genuine Muslim.
Well, that leads us perfectly into the next question, which is, for each of these conversations, we've identified a theme that somehow speaks to speaks from the vantage point, let's say, of the religious tradition that we're engaging. And so the theme for today's conversation, or a theme, is peace. And that seems to resonate so strongly with what you've just said. And in your own religious life and work, what's important to you when you consider the notion of peace? Tell us what you're thinking.
Yes. You know, of course, peace is multifaceted. There is, first of all, that great insight in every tradition that the peace outside can only happen if I am experiencing peace within myself. If I am continuously, in a very abiding way, doing the inner work of transforming my ego, opening up my heart. You know, Rumi has a wonderful verse. Rumi never wrote, just uttered. He says, you know the value of every article of merchandise, but if you don't know the value of your own soul, it's all foolishness. So the first thing I would say is that personal peace from doing that inner work. Second thing is the religious peace. All of us, we know, there is no place on earth where it is not a multi-religious society. And I want to hark back to what Gandhi in India said. Gandhi knew a lot about what it really takes to create peace in a multi-religious society. He would continuously make three points. Number one, he would say, it is the sacred duty of every individual to have an appreciative understanding of the other person's religion. He would say, it's not enough to say, I'm open-minded, non-prejudiced. He would ask, what are you open-minded about? That's point one. Point two, he would say, let's acknowledge every single religion has truths and untruths. And you would add with a wink, especially your own. And if somebody got excited, he would say, I'm not saying that the verses are not divine, but human consciousness is less than perfect. When human consciousness touches a divine verse, the interpretation can be less than divine. Third point, very quickly, he would say, if a religious extremist commits violence, does something wrong like that, he would say, I beg you, I beg you, I beg you, please, do not criticize this person's religion. Rather, point out to this person insights and verses of wisdom and beauty from this person's own tradition. So that's religious peace. Last one I would say is political peace, which comes from a deeper understanding of the issues, the political issues which are involved. Unless we really begin to resolve that, peace is difficult to come. So I would say in a large part of the Muslim world, until we resolve the political issue of the Arab-Israeli conflict, this difficulty will continue.
Well, I'm reminded of something that a friend of mine, and I think the rest of you know him as well, Professor Emeritus at Grinnell, Harold Kazimov, who's a scholar not only of Judaism but also of Buddhism and the world's religions. And he often says that every great religious tradition has verses of which it must repent, but it has to do that on its own. It doesn't need any help from people from the other traditions to point out.
Right, right. You know, this is a very good point you're bringing up, Jim. When I and my interfaith amigos, we go and talk in different places, and really we have, sometimes you get very large audiences, what they like about what we say is that, of course, we have to focus on the commonalities. But really it is also important for us to be willing to be vulnerable after we have established, should we say, trust, friendship, we have practiced three cups of tea, to begin to talk about what is difficult in our traditions, what is awkward, rather than deny it, avoid it, gloss over it, rather see that which is difficult, as an invitation to go deeper, to shine a higher light on it, to do, as Prophet Muhammad said, to move from a knowledge of the tongue to a knowledge of the heart. You know, again, I come back to Rumi. Rumi, when he examined this situation that every single tradition has difficulties, awkward verses, he had this wonderful trance utterance. He says, a bee and a wasp, they drink from the same flower. One produces nectar, other one produces a sting. He would say, when you look at a verse, which is difficult, ask yourself, what is my level of consciousness, number one? Number two, what is my intention? But attempt to produce nectar rather than a sting.
Wow, that's perfect. You've mentioned Rumi a couple of times. Can you just tell us a word or two about what you mean when you identify yourself as a Sufi, and what is Sufism? How can we understand it? And also, just say a word or two about how Sufism and Sufis are regarded in the larger Muslim tradition.
Thank you. Thank you for the opportunity. There's a great misunderstanding about Sufism or the word Sufi. Many non-Muslims, even Muslims actually, they sometimes think that Sufism is a denomination. You see, in Islam we have two main denominations, Sunni and Shia. Like, I'm a Sunni. 85% of the world's Muslims are Sunnis. 15% are Shias. And of course, as it usually happens, the bifurcation or fragmentation came about because of a very shall I say, absurd historical situation, but that's a whole different story. Sufis, or a Sufi, can be either a Sunni Muslim or a Shia Muslim, but is one who believes, rather than overly magnifying the institution of the religion, focusing too much on the rituals and the exactitude of the rituals, it's important to focus on the spirit of the tradition and live that tradition. The example they always give is that of a cup with a glass of water. We need the cup, the container. That's the institution. But what about the water inside? If we spend most of our life just polishing the outside of the cup, but don't really do anything about drinking the water, we're not really living the tradition. And Sufism, unknown to many, and even Muslims, has always been a very, very, very integral part of Islam. Islam spread, you know, maybe some through sword, but most of it really through the teachings of the Sufis. So, for example, if one asks, in which part of the world do you have the largest number of Muslims? The truth is, Islam is basically an Asian religion, although it started in the Arab countries. Arab countries don't make more than 15%, 15% of the entire Islamic world. Well over 60% of Muslims live in Asia. And in Asia, it is agreed, as also in other countries, the bulk of Islam has spread through the teachings of the Sufis. So they've always been a very integral part. And it's only in the last 200 years, when Islam has declined politically and economically, that some conservative Muslims, the ones who are literalists, they blame the Sufis for this decline. And so, for example, a country like Saudi Arabia is very much against Sufis. Even that is changing, though.
I wonder if at this point, if Barbara and Kathy have comments or things they'd like to add or questions to address to Jamal.
You know, I'm sorry, Barbara, did you want to go ahead?
No, I was just troubleshooting something here. Go ahead, Kathy.
You know, I have a question about jihad,
yes.
If that's all right,
yes,
to ask. And I understand that as
a
metaphysical concept of the holy war within. And yet it seems to have been taken so literally and in many ways. And I wonder if you could reflect on that, the history of that.
Yes.
Or...
Oh, yes. Oh, thank you very much. Because that's one of the questions I'm asked most often. And I think it's very telling that, for example, when the word jihad is mentioned, for many Westerners, it arouses fear in their hearts. And I can understand that, the reason for that. But for me as a Muslim, it arouses a feeling of sacredness, because my understanding of jihad is very different. The word jihad literally means effort, exertion. And jihad is divided into what is called the greater jihad and the lesser jihad. So you might say 90% of jihad is about making a personal effort to become a more complete human being. This work that I described about transforming the ego, opening up the heart, being of service, making sure that you are just in your relationships with others, you have a good relationship with your spouse, with your family, with your colleagues, with your society. All this requires a lot of effort to make sure that there is justice in the society, to be doing something about that in terms of giving of your being. It means an expenditure of your effort, of your time and energy. That's the real meaning of jihad. And then there's a lesser jihad, which means, and this is the one which is most misunderstood, if you're attacked, and if your religion particularly is attacked, it's totally defensive in theory, which means that you have a right to fight back. And I'll give you the exact quotation in the Quran, which is the basis of jihad. It says, fight in the way of God those who fight you, but begin not hostilities, for God loves not the aggressors. However, this understanding of jihad has been abused and misused by Muslims and non-Muslims. But what is most important to say, very unambiguously, is in the Quran, there's absolutely no reference to jihad as holy war. All of those the discussions you're seeing, the arguments you're seeing, is outside the Quran. In the Quran, jihad as holy war just does not exist. This is in the arguments and the writings of jurists outside of Islam. So jihad is a very multifaceted meaning, and it literally means effort and exertion.
Thank you.
There's a hadith, a saying concerning the Prophet that turns up all the time, Jamal, when Muhammad returns to Mecca after the long struggle from Medina and so on, and supposedly says, today is ended the smaller, the lesser jihad, and tomorrow begins the greater jihad. Is that accurate at all?
Yes, you know, actually what it is after returning from a battle, you know,
Uhud.
They said, you know, we have exactly Battle of Uhud, and actually they had lost the war, and he was badly wounded, the Prophet. He said, we have returned from the lesser jihad, lesser exertion, and now we have to do the greater jihad. They said, what does all this mean? He said, what really means is we have to do the work of transforming our ego, opening up our heart, and guess what? Many of the people disappeared because that was too much of it's hard work, you see? But that's the real meaning of jihad.
Mm-hmm.
That's the real meaning of jihad. There's a wonderful hadith. Hadith, of course, as you know, means saying of the Prophet. He said, I wonder how it goes, the ink of the scholar is far more holy than the blood of the martyr. So knowledge in Islam is highly valued, and that is why for 1,000 years there was a lot of wonderful, glorious outpourings and flourishing of sciences and architecture and literature. The word in Arabic for knowledge is ilm, I-L-M. And in the Quran, the most often used word is Allah, the Arabic for God. But the second most used word is ilm, knowledge. You must acquire knowledge. You must acquire knowledge. Of course, that is a very scarce commodity in the Islamic world these days, although things are changing rather rapidly in the last few decades.
This is Jim.
I was just going to ask. I was saying that, you know, I'm keeping my eye on the clock a little bit, and I wanted to, I don't really have a question or a comment, but I was eager to move on to the part of our interview with Jamal that actually brings to light some of the points that we've been making here, having to do with the fact that it's even the lesser or the problematic areas sometimes of a religious or cultural tradition that seems to get the most play, and I don't just a little bit kind of blame the superficial society and some of the superficial mainstream media for making the most of that. But what Jamal is saying, as we've been saying all along, is it's the lesser known or the understory of the religious tradition and culture that is really the predominant part of the humanity that lives that culture in the world. And therefore, I was eager to get on to the question that Jim had framed before about how this all interfaces in our local communities where people are endeavoring to understand one another's humanity despite the diversity that they see in their community, and how that is impacted by the media, which tends to be, you know, focusing on all the wrong things. So I wonder, Jim, if we might want to move on to that question.
Well, I was just about to say that in the 5 minutes remaining, we wanted to address the question of the current phenomenon, if this is what you're pointing to, Barbara, of Islamophobia in the U.S. and the so-called Ground Zero Mosque controversy, the concern about the imposition of Sharia law. A candidate for the Senate in Nevada today made a major statement that several cities in the United States have already fallen under the sway of Sharia law and are now controlled by Sharia law. And I just wonder what your reaction to some of this nonsense is. And let me frame it in a larger way, too. If you concentrate only on that, you could be forgiven for saying that things aren't getting better in terms of interfaith or interreligious understanding. But I think you and I and Barbara and Kathy are all convinced that in a way things are getting dramatically better. What's your take on all of that? I know it's a huge question.
Yes. You know, Jim, I missed a large part of the question because my line got cut. But I think I got your last part. The first thing I wanted to say was that, you know, a lot of this problem going on, it sounds religious, but as you, of course, have noted, religious is actually a cover for disguising some other matter which is at the root. For example, in this case, we know that it is politics. It's about money and power. There's a saying in Islam that we're looking in the flowers and branches for what really appears in the roots. There was a Gallup poll done about a year ago, which went to 37 Muslim countries, the largest of its kind, interviewed about, they covered 90% of the Islamic world, and their conclusion was this. Yes, there is militancy in Islam. They figured it to be 2%. But they said they're absolutely clear that this militancy, 100% they were saying, this militancy is not based on Islamic principles. it's based on political radicalization. So at the root of it is politics. This Islamophobia we are seeing today, of course, you know, it has its roots in this, in the politics, in the economic hardship going on today, in the polarization of the two parties, and also a major factor is really a total, as Gandhi would say, not even not knowing about the other's tradition, having almost no knowledge about the other's tradition on all sides, so it becomes very easy to stereotype. Let me give you the example of Sharia. Sharia strikes a lot of fear in people, but it is very telling that in the Gallup poll that happened last year, most of the people who support the Sharia are women. Now, this might sound very, very paradoxical, because they know what Sharia means. Sharia is not a law. The word Sharia, Sharia, means the pathway to the wellspring. So Sharia is a set of principles by which, from the Quran and the sayings of the Prophet, you derive certain principles, certain laws, certain ways of living. And therefore, you can imagine the Sharia law, or the it's called fiqh, from the Sharia principles, is very, very varied. So you can go Sharia shopping, just as you can go fatwa shopping. Fatwa means a scholarly opinion by some scholars. Different scholars have different opinions based on their understanding of the Quran and their understanding of the Prophet. The women say that the Sharia that men have enacted is not Sharia compliant. They have to be Sharia compliant. The women say there's no such thing as the Bible or the Torah or the Quran says this. The question is, who says the Quran says this? It's usually always men. And it's the male-centered ego that comes up with these laws. So the women are saying, make the laws more Sharia compliant. That is essential.
In other words, more grounded in the true faith.
Yes, in the true verses of the Quran. For example, you know, the women always point out that all those verses in the Quran that were meant to favor women, and they did favor women in the time of Prophet Muhammad, but after he died and Islam spread to patriarchal societies, all those same verses which were totally for favor of women, for their protection, for their goodness to happen and to grow, have all been turned to be in favor of men. And this, the women are saying, is unacceptable. And they're taking steps to change that. They've realized they have to follow the path of getting an education. So today, the best news in the Islamic world is that in almost every institution of higher learning in Muslim countries, the largest number of enrollees are women. In Iran, you have an example where... Beg your pardon?
I
was thinking Iran, it's amazing that the number of female PhDs is far more than the men who have PhDs. It's already happening.
I was just starting to say, as we wind up, that I can't imagine a better answer to the question that you didn't hear, because your line got cut, which is,
yes.
Even though there are so many signs of what appears to be devolution, are we really evolving toward greater interreligious understanding and engagement? And I think what you've just said is a perfect answer to that. We are indeed.
Thank you. Yes.
I just want to, before we wind up with Jamal, I just want to point out that in today's New York Times, there's an extraordinary story about the first Roman Catholic Church in New York, founded in 1785. It's still open, the oldest church, Catholic church in New York, St. Peter's. And the reaction to the opening of that church was almost identical to the reaction to the so-called Ground Zero Mosque. It's an extremely enlightening article. And it also suggests that this too shall pass. So, Jamal, I think the question on everyone's mind is, so what can I do? What can we do? We can all learn more and need to learn more about our own traditions and about other traditions, as a recent survey demonstrated pretty clearly. But beyond that, what can we do to hasten the advance of interreligious understanding and engagement?
You know, the first thing I would say is to understand what interfaith is and to remove some of the fears that people have. We always like to say interfaith is not about conversion. It's about completion, becoming a more complete human being. And usually, almost close to 100%, people who do study other traditions, they begin to understand more deeply their own tradition. You begin to water your own roots and really have a deeper understanding. The main point I wanted to make was for really engendering peace and harmony in a multi-religious society, it's very important that I establish a connection with the other, establish a human connection with the other. The Quran says God has deliberately created diversity only for one reason, that you might get to know one another. In all of my years and other people I know, they say the key program, the key insight is really to have a human relationship. I tell every Muslim, you must take the initiative to get to know a Christian, a Jew, your neighbor who's different. So number one is friendship. You know, if you want peace with Muslims, get to know a Muslim. Muslims get to know the other, number one. Number two, there are a lot of wonderful programs. There's a program called the Amazing Faith Projects. Over dinner, you can have a wonderful discussion, and it's designed in such a way, and the questions are all given out there, that people are really listening to the other. Just Google that kindly, the Amazing Faith Projects. Third thing is programs where you share spiritual practices. In Seattle, we do, among the Abrahamic faiths, the three-day Sabbath. On a Friday, we all get together, Muslims and non-Muslims, and we participate or we witness an Islamic body prayer. In the evening, Friday evening, we all participate in the Jewish Shabbat. On Saturday, we have a workshop to learn about one another's traditions in an appreciative way. And on Sunday, we all participate in a Sunday service. That seems to create an inner spaciousness, which allows me not only to tolerate, but to celebrate diversity. So I just wanted to mention a few of those practical steps we can take.